Savvy greetings to the staff of Nemeta. This is the main professor, of course, recording on the evening of, the morning actually, of December 13th, 2019. The title of this talk is A Dose of Their Own Medicine. I'm placing this talk in the course page dedicated to the Dragonfly Sutra, and specifically in the block to contain units on Medicine Buddha. That's how you say it. You don't say the Medicine Buddha. They have their version of the Medicine Buddha. But I'm privileged and delighted to inform you that there is another Medicine Buddha, and they didn't see this one coming. Now, this talk is rather impromptu. I didn't intend to introduce Medicine Buddha quite yet, but something happened within the last 24 hours which has me spinning and fluttering, and I felt compelled to compose the text for this unit and to record an audio. Now, you notice there is a subtitle to the title of this unit, Introductory Remarks on Medicine Buddha, including a short examination of delusions of grandeur particular to the main tertön. So I've been reflecting on my megalomania lately, and I could say I've really been relishing it. I've been looking at my delusions of grandeur, or what must appear to be delusions of grandeur to some tads here or there around the planet. And these reflections have brought me some long-awaited happiness. So I feel compelled to share this happiness with you. The topic in play is one that is really close to my heart. The topic belongs to a certain thread in my destiny. So there are a couple of personal anecdotes I'm going to relate purely for the purposes of illustration. The point is, I will be talking about something that is deeply mysterious. The workings of destiny are deeply mysterious. And yet, they manifest in existential situations, encounters, and opportunities that sometimes pan out and sometimes fail. To begin, I have the pleasure of introducing you to someone, a Tibetan tertön, perhaps, who perhaps might be considered as the premier tertön of the Nyingma tradition of Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhism. And that would be Longchenpa. Now, Longchenpa lived from 1308 to 1364. And as the note indicates in the text, he was a major teacher of the Nyingma school. And he was a critical link. He provided a critical link in the exoteric and esoteric transmission of Dzogchen. I might also add that Longchenpa is a key figure in Sophia's dreaming with respect to what I have called the Vajrayana romance. Wolfram von Eschenbach completed Parsifal around 1220. And about 50 years earlier, when he would have been a child, or perhaps a teenager, there was a huge gabble around Europe that went on for centuries. And it concerned a rumor about contact between Christian leaders in the West, including the Pope, and the head of a mysterious kingdom in the East, known as Prester John, meaning the Elder John. Now, there's a lot of disinfo and distortion around this story. It's heavily overwritten by Christian scribes and ideologues who want to claim this extraordinary East-West connection as part of their heritage, and they want to take credit for it in whatever way they can. The whole controversy is based on a letter, was kicked off by a letter sent to Pope Alexander II, dated September 27th, 1177. Now, this letter has been proven to be a fabrication. In fact, Lev Gumilev wrote a fascinating book about it, entirely dedicated to the topic of the kingdom of Prester John. Now, it's well worth noting that Wolfram, who, as I say, lived at the time that this controversy broke into the exopsyche, made a point of referring to Prester John in the last chapter of Parsifal. According to his insider view, Firfiz was the half-brother, French-Lebanese, of Parsifal, married Réponse de Choix, who was the Grail Maiden. And they both went to the Far East together, where they presented the holy relic of the Grail to Elder John. Now, this fragment of folklore from the Diaspora of the Mysteries is the leading clue to a huge story, the Vajrayana romance, the marriage of East and West, as it has been called by some academics, but more specifically, the insemination of Grail and Gnosis into the culture of Asia. One could say into the high spiritual culture of Asia. Now, Longchenpa himself lived just a century after Parsifal was completed. And at that time, the Grail-Tibet-Vajrayana link was developing in the remote fastnesses of Asia beyond the Himalayas. As I have often argued, the Grail shows up in Vajrayana as a mystical trope, the wish-fulfilling gem. Today, that gem stands central to the Shakti cluster. It is the Vajra star, composed of five diamond sky dakinis positioned on the petals of the internal floret. So, all that information belongs to the great and grand trauma of the Vajrayana romance. It so happens that the constellation of the fishes is intimately connected with that event, which is an ongoing event, And the timing of the stars in the constellation of the fishes, especially the stars that compose the thread that connects the two fishes, can be computed to historical dates which record with great exactitude key events, key historical events in the Vajrayana romance. Just so happens that the apogee of the moon, after having been stalled in the Manitou for an extraordinary period of time this year, has just now, only now, shifted into the fishes. Well, what do you think of that? And currently, it's located under the nose of the western fish, and it will progress through the fishes in the course of 2020, and will perform a stall in the fishes. So the constellation of the fishes, or whales, is a celestial display that reflects the historical continuity of this profound liaison between East and West. That connection, that cross-fertilization, belongs to the continuation of the story of the Grail Keepers and the diaspora of the mysteries. Tremendous studies could be made of this narrative, which comes under the watchful guidance of Swandeva, the storykeeper. She is, of course, a diamond sky Dakini herself, and she is identified as point 11 in the Shakti cluster. Now, I can assure you that the scope and sweep of the events that play into this narrative are really, really immense. And yet what I can tell you more directly, what I can relate more directly, is two particular incidents that illustrate my involvement in the Vajrayana romance, which is extensive, by the way. But these two particular incidents were seminal incidents. The first one occurred in the fall of 1997, I believe. That was when I went to the Marian Foundation in Marian, Massachusetts, which is about an hour and a half from Boston, and it's on the coast. It was called at that time the Marian Foundation. And when I arrived there, at their offices, which was also a large building where they had a lecture hall where I came to talk eventually, on that first occasion, I was the co-presenter with Graham Hancock. And the day I walked into those beautifully furnished, elegant and tasteful surroundings, I was surprised to learn that there was an association called the Buddhayana Foundation located in the same building. And so I was invited to go meet Harold Talbot, who was the head of the foundation. Now, as the notes show, Buddhayana Foundation was established by Michael Baldwin, one of the founders of the Marian Institute, and Harold Talbot, specifically for the purpose of supporting a Tibetan scholar named Tulku Tondap. And so it had existed already for about 17 or 18 years by the time that I arrived. And I can remember very clearly when I walked into the office, my eyes immediately went to the right. I entered the door, and my eyes immediately went to the right to a Tonka, beautifully framed Tonka, illustrating Padmasambhava, who is regarded as the founder of Tibetan Buddhism. And I was standing there, feeling very excited, delighted, happy, feeling open and welcome. And so I chatted with Harold Talbot. I vividly can picture the scene. I almost have a holographic memory of it. And he saw that I was looking at this Tonka, and he said, "Oh yes, that's Precious Guru, Guru Rinpoche." It's a common term that devotees use to refer to Padmasambhava. And I went over and looked at the Tonka closely, and I noted, as one must note if you look closely, the small mustache. I noted that detail. Well, at that time, I wasn't able to make a comment about that mustache. It was only some years later, actually about 10 years later, that I received the intel about Padmasambhava and why he's always portrayed with a very thin mustache, which you don't see on other figures of gurus and masters idolized by Buddhists. You don't see it, do you? You don't see that Longchenpa has a mustache, do you? It's quite unusual. However, that was a clue presented to me at the time in that particular context. And the conversation played around the subject of Tibetan Buddhism, obviously. And right off the bat, within 5 minutes, chatting lightly and genially with Harold Talbot, he brought up two topics: Longchenpa and the Longchen Nyingtig. And that was the first time in my life that I had ever heard anyone say Longchen Nyingtig. And it was like a ping. Now, I already knew something about Longchenpa, quite a bit actually. And so I said to Harold Talbot, and I remember laughing while I said it. I laughed a lot actually in that conversation. I said, "Oh yeah, Longchenpa, well, that's my family, you know, that's my lineage." And he was kind of taken aback by that. I suppose he might have thought that I was implying that I had been a long-time student of Dzogchen, following the teachings of Longchenpa, which was not at all the case. So I said, Nyingma, that's kind of my clan, you know. I really feel part of that clan. I've always felt like they were my family, like, you know, maybe cousins or something, you know. The Nyingmapa, the oldest school of Tibetan Buddhism, the one that is most closely tied to pre-Buddhist Tibet and to the Bon religion or the Bon shamanism of pre-Buddhist Tibet. And I told Harold Talbot, you know, without reservation and without making a big deal about it, I mean, really, quite casually, I told him that, yeah, and Longchenpa, I mean, we're really close. Actually, he was my pet raccoon in a former life. I can't remember exactly how Harold responded to that remark. But, you know, he didn't appear to be taken aback too much. And there was such a warm and genial feeling between us that we just continued to chatter on. So he went back to the subject of the Long Chen Nying Tig, N-Y-I-N-G-T-H-I-G. And that's Tibetan for heart essence or seminal heart. So the full translation would be the seminal heart of Long Chenpa, that is to say, a name, reverential name, given to the work that came through him, the instruction that came through him in the form of a terma. So he was a Tertan, and another Tertan who lived after him, about 450 years after him, was Jigme Lingpa. And he was the Tertan, Harold Talbot informed me, who had received or retrieved or recovered the terma left by Long Chenpa. And this was an example, in fact, it's the supreme example of the transmission of elaborate and sophisticated Buddhist wisdom through Tertans. Well, I knew what a Tertan was. I'm pretty sure that's the first time I ever heard the name Jigme Lingpa spoken by anyone. So I want you to get the picture, and I'm standing there in this office in a building which is dripping with elegant art, including quite a few probably rather expensive Tibetan tankas beautifully framed in the hallway and the offices. And I'm hearing these words for the first time, and I respond with delight. And I assure Harold Talbot, I think somewhat to his bafflement, that I consider myself to be intimately connected with the lineage of Nyingmapa. So there's a little incident, there's a little anecdote, which is part of the great narrative of the Vajrayana romance. And the follow-up to that incident occurred in the same place, about 2 years later. It was in November of 2001, right after 9/11. Now, on that occasion, I had come to the Marian Foundation to speak with Elaine Pagels, who wrote the Gnostic Gospels. And my role in that event was to introduce to the attendees, and it happened to be an event, I think, of 120 people, standing room only, to introduce the message of Gnosticism, of which they knew absolutely nothing. So I came there as a heretic to speak about Gnosticism. It was a lovely compliment to my first presentation in Marion with Graham Hancock, where I came as an emissary of the mysteries. So during that talk, one of the attendees was none other than Tulku Tondap. And after the main presentation, he actually came up to me, and I think I knew who he was. He didn't have to introduce himself. And he shook my hand and thanked me and said, "Well, you must write a book about this. You must put it into a book." So he prompted me to write a book. And he also very kindly invited me to come and see him when I was in Boston, to come and see him at his little apartment in Cambridge, which I did eventually do. And that little anecdote will be the third anecdote that I relay in the context of the Vajrayana romance. It was another key moment. But at that moment that he invited me to come and see him, I looked at him very squarely and I said, "Can you make me a tuna fish sandwich?" And he hesitated a little bit, and as if I had said something inappropriate. And then he said very politely, "Oh yes, we can find something to have for lunch." Now, stop the camera right here. That was the conversation that actually took place. That was the scene that was enacted, and those were the two lines in the script. But those were not the complete lines in my script. You see, I chose at that moment, I'm talking about, 18 years ago here, I chose at that moment not to push it. I saw from the way that he responded to my question, "Can you make me a tuna fish sandwich?" that he didn't get my question. So imagine another script. Imagine the full script. It would have gone like this. "Can you make me a tuna fish sandwich?" Now, if I had said it in that way, if I had pushed it, if I had insisted, let's just suppose that he responded appropriately. In that case, the script would have read like this. "Can you make me a tuna fish sandwich?" "Oh yes, I can," TT replies. JL: "Well, can we go to the market together and buy the tuna?" TT responds, "Oh, yeah, sure, if you want to do that." JLL continues, "Can we be sure that we're going to find dolphin-safe tuna? Do you know how to look for that?" "Oh, sure, yes," TT responds. "Very important that we get dolphin-safe tuna." JLL continues, pushing it. "Yeah, great. Well, we'll go to the market together so that when we get back, you can make a tuna fish sandwich for me. And by the way, I'm just wondering, when we're in the market, like when we're in the checkout line, are we going to propound any of the Dharma to the people standing in the line? You know, the completely random strangers standing there, waiting to pay for their purchases." "Well, of course, I can't continue writing this script because that conversation didn't go that way, even though the Nahual is that which cannot be restrained. I have restrained myself a good many times, probably a good many too many. So I don't know what Tulku Tondup would have said about expounding the Dharma to random strangers in the checkout line, do I? Nobody knows." Moving on now, the script continues. Second scene, meeting between JL and TT, as he likes to be called. So I show up at his little apartment in Cambridge, which is not far from the rather classy little B&B where I'm staying, called the Irving House. And we sit there and we have lunch and tea, I think, and we talk. And on that occasion, I asked him If you thought it was possible, have I told this story before? This is the last time I'm going to tell it. I asked him if he thought it would be possible for Tertons to appear in the world completely outside of the Nyingma tradition, in fact, indeed, outside of the Buddhist tradition altogether. And he said, yeah, thoughtfully, yes, that could happen. Yes, it could. And then he stopped and pondered for a moment, kind of furrowed his brow slightly, and he said, but there would have to be some form of authentication. Some form of authentication that the terma was genuine, because it is known in Nyingma tradition that there are such things as false termas. So at the time he said that to me, November 2001, it was still 7 years before the terma of Gaia awakening happened. And once I had the terma and I started to develop it, I realized that I needed to establish standards and criteria to authenticate the terma. And that is indeed what I did. And so you'll see in the text of this unit that I have extracted from an essay written in 2011 and posted on metahistory.org. And there I set out 9 standards for the authentication of a terma. Now, I want to make it clear that I consider these standards to apply to myself, of course, but not just to myself. These standards also apply to any example that you might choose from the legacy of the Tertons in Tibetan Buddhism. So they are standards for the Buddhists as well as myself, and of course they are standards for anyone else who would come forth with the daring assertion that they have received a terma. And there are the conditions for everyone to read. But you might notice, as you read through them, that the 9th condition is location. Now, recently I saw a sort of documentary on the internet about a group of people, some of them lamas and some of them just ordinary people, who remembered Chogyam Trungpa during the time that he lived in Tibet before he fled to India. And they knew him when he was a boy and when he was a teenager. And I learned, to my surprise, I'll provide a link to that documentary, that Trungpa was also a Terton. And in one section of the documentary, the group who are commemorating him, who are celebrating his life and his memory, go on a long jaunt out into the mountains, and they actually go to these places where Trungpa is said to have discovered Tertons, and they relate the stories that go along with this, miracle tales, as you might call them, very, very common in Tibetan Buddhism. And they show exactly the places where Trungpa received a terma or found a terma buried in the rock and so forth and so on. I consider it of the utmost importance that the whole world knows that the terma of Gaia awakening happened in Andalusia, in the Serranía de Ronda of Spain. And that is a very great fact. And so I provide here a picture, not of the place where the terma came, but of a place nearby, Sanlúcar de Barrameda, at the mouth of the Guadalquivir River. And that is actually the place from which Columbus set out for the New World. Now remember that the intention of Columbus's journey was to reach the Far East, wasn't it? You see? To reach India. He knew the world was round, so he thought if he sailed around the world long enough toward the west, he would arrive in the Far East, which is absolutely true. However, he didn't get there because he ran into the Americas on the way. Nevertheless, I think it's fair to say that the journey of Columbus could be considered as a major episode in the Vajrayana romance due to the fact that his intention was to go to the east, to reach the east. So there's a small, odd twist in the plot. Make of it what you will. So moving on now from these three incidents that occurred in Marian, I want to bring you to what has happened in the last 24 hours. Since opening the subject of the Dragonfly Sutra on Nemata, I've had the occasion to go back and look at some of the Buddhist teachings that I have studied through many years. I have quite a collection, and some of these books have been worked through quite thoroughly. The Life and Teachings of Naropa, Kindly Bent to Ease Us, by Longchenpa, You Are the Eyes of the World, by Longchenpa, and half a dozen others that I could mention, but I won't. I've gone back and revisited these materials just in order to see how I managed them and how I worked my way through them, because those books have notes in them and they have yellow stickers on pages and they have certain words marked and certain phrases. So they contain a record of how I worked my way through Buddhism, going all the way back to the discovery of Alan Watts in Tokyo around 1965, if you can believe that. Now, it so happens that one of the Buddhist scholars whom I read extensively and who influenced me deeply was a Canadian named Herbert V. Guenther. I think that's how you would pronounce his name, G-U-E-N-T-H-E-R. And I was particularly fond of the three-volume edition of Longchenpa's work entitled Kindly Bent to Ease Us, which was translated by Guenther. I have here in my hand a copy of the first volume, purchased on July 14, 1977, in Los Angeles. So I picked this book up the other day, and I noticed that on the first page, Guenther gives the birth date of Longchenpa. He was born on the 8th day of the 2nd lunar month of the Earth male ape year, that is, Friday, 1st of March, 1308. And so, I decided to go down to my computer and bring up Starbase, which is the astronomical software for Celestics, put in the data for Longchenpa, and see what comes up. Now you realize, of course, that what I'm talking about here is celestics. I'm talking about the technicalities of reading a manifold. And some of you are not versed in celestics. So let me assure you that all you need to know is that the manifold is the pattern of planets, including the moon, which is not a planet, and including other astronomical factors such as the lunar nodes and the lunar apogee and perigee, as they are situated in the actual constellations at the moment of birth. So celestics uses a circular map called the rim sight. On the rim sight are graphic illustrations of the 13 constellations on the ecliptic. And so these elements of the manifold, of which there are 16, so it's called the sweet 16, these elements of the manifold are seen to be located somewhere or other in these 13 constellations. So when you're born, you might have Mercury in the ram, you might have the sun in the fishes, you might have Jupiter in the scales, you might have Saturn in the snake tamer, and so forth and so on. Each one of those 16 elements of the manifold actually stands graphically somewhere in the 13 constellations. And the study of the manifold is the work of celestics. And one of the aspects of celestics, which makes it beautifully engaging and entertaining, is the comparison of manifolds. So when you have a manifold of an artist or a writer, say Beethoven, great composer, or of an artist like Matisse, or a writer like John Le Carré, generally, however, manifolds of exemplars, as they're called, are of people who have died. I think John Le Carré is still alive. So let's consider how many of the well-known artists all around the world, you know, the Japanese novelist Yukio Mishima, Michelangelo, Isabella of Spain, you name it. These are the exemplars, people who lived before us. And by looking at the manifold of an exemplar and comparing it to the manifold of someone living today, we can track what is called phylogenetic transfer, which simply means that someone living in the past, such as Isabella of Spain, not an artist but a great heroine, achieved certain accomplishments. And those accomplishments are not lost. They are retained in the genetic system of the anthropos, and they are recycled and they reappear in the manifolds of other people. This is called the study of exemplars in celestics. So there's Longchenpa. He's an exemplar. And I decided to take a look at his manifold. And, of course, by chance, I thought I'd put it side by side with mine and see if there are any connections. Now, I'm not going to go into those connections at all. Rather, I'm going to point out five aspects of the manifold of Longchenpa which came to my attention in the last 24 hours and have given me the occasion to present these reflections on my delusions of grandeur. You could say that what I found was that the manifold of Longchenpa confirms my delusions of grandeur. And in particular, confirms my claim to introduce the Maitreya process, and in doing so, to entirely take down Buddhism, to demolish it, to demolish a structure that is already collapsing, a structure already in ruins, but to just demolish it and clear the ground. And if it pleases me to do so, I can draw upon any aspect of Buddhism, and I can remake it and reshape it into something that is appropriate for the closing years of Kali Yuga. Now, I didn't know I could do that when I talked to Tulku Tondup about the possibility of a Tertan just popping up out of nowhere. I was, of course, referring to myself. But that was 2001, and the Terma came 7 years later. I told him that I had had experiences in my life which I thought, or which I imagined, supposed, that were somewhat Terma-like. But I didn't sit there in his apartment with him and tell him that I had received a Terma, because that Terma was still 7 years in the future. Also, you may recall, and this is another episode relating to myself in the frame of the Vajrayana romance, that I had that extraordinary audience with Dudjom Rinpoche, who was the last great master of the Nyingma tradition, and that he had given me by mind transmission the whole yana yana yana, the 9 yards of yana yana yana, and the entire treasure of Nyingma in all its principles and practices for me to play with and convert to my liking. However, that was around 1985, and it wasn't until I received the Terma that I could actually do what Dzogchen Rinpoche had given me permission to do. So, you see how the plot develops here. These meetings that I've had, although they have been brief encounters, these meetings with these Tibetans, and also with Harold Talbot on that beautiful fall day in Marion, well, they're small incidents, almost random. And there was no follow-up to these incidents. I did not develop relationships in any case with these individuals. Nevertheless, there is some kind of continuity in these events, and some kind of deep and mysterious shaping power worked through them and worked on me, brought me to the Terma, and brought me also to the moment of the Dragonfly Sutra. Now, when I put Nemitta online, September of 2018, I already knew about the Maitreya process. I spoke about the Maitreya process and wrote about it already. And so I had a pretty good idea that if the moment for the Maitreya process had arrived, then the takedown of Buddhism was inevitable. But not until I got the Dragonfly Sutra, not until I composed it, did I actually see the course ahead. And along with the Dragonfly Sutra came this funny little character, Medicine Buddha. So all of this has been developing for a while, right? And some of you, I'm sure, have been tracking me closely. But what happened in the last 24 hours is rather extraordinary. So let me just cut to the chase, as Michael Baldwin used to say. Or was it cut to the fuck? I can't remember. And let's take a look at these five points that I discovered looking at the manifold of Long Chenpa. Now, once I had it on the screen in Starbase, the first thing I went to look for was Jupiter. I wanted to know, where was Jupiter when Long Chenpa was born? Jupiter, as you know, represents the guru principle, the teacher, the higher education of the human races, and it's closely associated with Thelite, the consort of the Aeon Sophia, your divine mother. And it is the planet that naturally comes to mind when you're looking at the chart of a philosopher. In the system of interpretation of the manifold, the celestician considers that Jupiter is the instrument for the social message of that person. There's a social mission, which is Saturn, and then there's a social message. So I thought, well, wow, I would really like to know what Celestics tells me about the social message of Long Chenpa, the paramount Nyingma Turton, who lived in the 14th century. And what do I find when I look at his manifold? I find that Jupiter was located in 284 of the ecliptic, in the constellation of the Archer, 1 degree from the star Nunci, or Sigma Sagittari. And that star marks the vein of the arrow drawn back by the hand of the Archer, Nunci. And that position is exactly where Jupiter was located on the 8th of August, 2008, when I received the Terma of Gaia Awakening. As the saying goes, you can't make this stuff up. Now let me quickly recount the other four features of Long Chenpa's manifold, which confirm the truth, the veracity, the living embodied veracity and power of the Vajrayana romance and his diachronic link to PT and, if you will, to the main Turton. In every manifold, you find the lunar nodes, which are opposite to each other, the south or descending, and the north or ascending lunar node. And you also find the perigee and the apogee of the moon, which are really important points in evaluating the phylogenetic inheritance of any character, any person, any subject. It so happens that Long Chenpa has a remarkable configuration, that the south lunar node and the perigee of the moon and the planet Mercury are all located in what is now the area of 1516 Aries, which happens to be in the constellation of the fishes or the whales, and it happens to be the location of the perihelion of the planet Jupiter. In other words, the apsides of the planet Jupiter, I'm talking astronomy here, this is not astrology, the line that divides its elliptical orbit, indicating a near point and a far point. Jupiter's near point to the sun, the perihelion. Jupiter's far point to the sun, the aphelion. So the lunar node, the moon's perigee, and Mercury are clustered at the perihelion of Jupiter. Now, I indicated during the Gaia navigation experiment that the correction of the aeons of Phaia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. The odds, by the way, of having three elements of the manifold, including Mercury, which moves rapidly, including the perigee of the moon, which is extremely erratic, clustered together and aligned to the apsides of Jupiter are pretty, pretty low. The correction of the aeons of Phaia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter, where these planets, where these elements are located in the manifold of Long Chenpa. So the lunar nodes themselves, north and south, are actually aligned to the apsides of Jupiter. That means that the north lunar node is in the area that is now 15 or 16 Libra, in the womb of the Virgin. And of course, the Virgin is the image of the Aeon Sophia on the ecliptic, Isis Sophia, as I called her in the dedication of the Seeker's Handbook. Two final points. Longchenpa was born at the Uranus-Neptune conjunction of 1308, and I have often spoken about this conjunction and how it represents the romantic impulse. In fact, the first article that I ever got published was in a Dutch magazine in which I wrote about the romantic impulse and the periodic conjunctions of Uranus and Neptune. And in this case, the conjunction occurs in the claws of the constellation of the Scorpion, jarring the scales. Well, as I explained in the GNE, the image of the Scorpion jarring the scales is the image of reset. The Aeonic Mother resets the scales. So not only the overarching concept of correction is indicated in Longchenpa's manifold, but specifically the sign or omen of reset. Finally, the Earth at his birth is placed in 179 of the ecliptic, very close to the fall equinox, where the fall equinox stands today, and that is actually in the forehead of the Virgin. So you could say, and that's the Earth, Longchenpa's Earth, which is the myth he loves, which is his purpose. The Earth is your purpose. It's the truth on which you stand. The truth on which he stood was the truth of the great Virgin of the world, the Aeon Sophia. So what I found in these four elements, indulge me, if you will, is a rather thorough, meticulous, and totally astonishing confirmation of everything that I am teaching about the correction of the aeons of fire, speaking as a Gnostic, but at the same time indulging myself in delusions of grandeur about being some kind of Turton. Ay, caramba! And so it goes. All of these considerations can stand now as a sort of long preview, a glimpse of this wacky character, Medicine Buddha. What exactly is Medicine Buddha? Well, it's a ventriloquist dummy that sits on the Maitreya's leg, the left leg, because that's the one that is pulled up. And the joke is that Medicine Buddha gives Buddhists living today a dose of their own medicine. You know, the Buddhists have been out there for 2,500 years propounding the Dharma, expounding on the Dharma, and delivering the medicine of the Dharma to the world. And now the time has come for the medicine to come to them. The medicine to liberate them comes to them now. And it comes through the mouth of this pig that sits in the lap of the Maitreya, you could say. What does Medicine Buddha actually look like? Well, there's an image for you. It's what we call in America a piggy bank, like a Porky Pig piggy bank, a cutesy little plastic relic. And the kick is, and it really is a kick, I mean, I'm getting a hell of a kick out of it as long as I last. It only gets better. The kick comes in a totally unanticipated turnaround. You know, the Maitreya is a figure that belongs to the tradition of Buddhism. There are a few references to the Maitreya, not many. You know, there are something like predictions about the coming of the Bodhisattva Maitreya, the future Buddha, the Buddha for the end of Kali Yuga, and there are dates that place it right now, place that coming right now. There's one treatise that refers to 500-year periods. Well, it's 2,500 years since the historical Buddha lived. But to the best of my knowledge, now correct me if I'm wrong, Buddhists living in the world today and those who preserve this tradition assume that the Maitreya comes to restore the Dharma. But the joke is, the Maitreya comes to demolish the Dharma and to liberate Buddhists from a dead-end situation. The Maitreya comes to euthanize Buddhism. Rather mercifully, however, I must say. Well, who knows? It's going to be viewed, if anyone catches on to it at all, which is may never happen, but it's likely to be viewed as a serious act of aggression against Buddhism and Buddhists. And I'm perfectly happy if anyone wants to take it in that way. In fact, there's a large grain of truth in that view. On the other hand, you know, speaking out of my own humble person, I would just have to say that any Buddhists don't get the message here, or don't even want to know that there is a message for Buddhists. Well, fuck you if you can't take a joke. There's good reason why Medicine Buddha, the ventriloquist dummy of the Maitreya, resembles a piggy bank. You know, there's a little slot at the top of the plastic piggy bank for small change, pennies, or maybe larger coins. One of the demands of the Maitreya is that the Buddhists liquidate all their resources and they turn over all their wealth and all their facilities to the implementation of the Maitreya process. Get off it. Get over it. There's a new game in town. I said recently that it's really, really too late for all this in a way. It's too late, for instance, for me to go gallivanting around the world or sit on some platforms in some lecture hall somewhere debating with one Rinpoche or Lama or another, which I could easily do and enjoy. But it's probably too late for all that. Hey, no problem. No pasa nada. I will say, if the Dalai Lama shows up in Europe anytime soon, I'm going to go find him. And I'm going to tell him that I have a message for him. And the message is from the Maitreya. Does he want to know what it is? And if he says yes, I'll say, you can stop now. And then I'll discuss that suggestion with him, if he's up for it. And then, if he's really receptive, I would explain that I'm talking about the consummate end of the Dharma. That is to say, its consummation. It's gone to seed. Yet its consummation is something beautiful and glorious to behold. In fact, it achieves, it accomplishes, it reaches its final purpose. Its great completion, Dzogchen, in the moment when it is surrendered. And as for Medicine Buddha, it has some specific and simplific instructions for Buddhists. Teaching of the Maitreya is for the entire world, but the message of Medicine Buddha, that dummy, is specifically for Buddhists to help them get over it. And while the time goes by, and no one in the Buddhist world yet even knows anything about this of which I speak, Medicine Buddha rehearses a little nursery rhyme. As Trungpa said, the true teacher is kind of like a babysitter. So, Medicine Buddha murmurs a little nursery rhyme, and it goes like this. There once was a Maitreya tree that sparkled on a hill, and those who did the Maitreya see corrected every ill. Tathagata